Michael Barone is on the show. He is a senior writer at U.S. News and World Report. About 5 years ago, just before the 9/11 attack, he wrote a book called The New Americans, How the Melting Pot Can Work Again. At the time, there was not a lot of discussion of illegal immigration or immigration of any kind in this country, and he stirred it up with his book. Now the book has been re-released in paperback, and he has written a new preface that includes commentary on not only immigration, but terrorism and how to deal with all of this. Michael, welcome to KMOX.
Well, it's nice to be on KMOX again.
Nice to have you here. As I was looking up what I was going to talk to you about today, I found a story from San Ysidro, California, of a guy who was stopped at the border driving into the country in a GMC van, looking a little bit nervous, and so they took him over to this area where they do a secondary check on him, and they also checked out the van, and there were three undocumented migrants sewn into the seats of this conversion van, including a woman who was actually sitting inside the driver's seat. And I thought to myself, right there is part of our problem, but the question is, what is the solution?
Think of all the work they had to do to sew those people into the seat. It's kind of daunting, isn't it?
It tells me a lot about how much people want to get into this country.
Well, people vote with their feet for the United States. You know, of all the immigrants around the world, about half of them every year come to the United States. We've got 4% of the world's population. We attract 50% of the world's immigrants.
There's been a lot of talk about it this year. Is that because it's an election year and it's all about politics? Are there any real solutions being offered by anybody?
Well, I think there are some real solutions being offered by people. You know, there's some people that are in there's areas of legitimate disagreement, I think. George W. Bush was talking about the immigration system in the 2000 campaign and basically has adhered to the stand he took then. Congress this year and last year finally took up the issue, realizing that we've got about 10 to 12 million people illegally here in the United States. I think the September 11th attacks highlighted for all of us the possibility that this is a security threat. Many of these people were illegally within hijackers were illegally in the United States, and they'd overstayed their visas or whatever. So that's a concern. Numerically, it's probably not a huge concern, but the fact is that our immigration laws are not working, and they're not working as well as we're not handling immigration as well as we handled it in the past.
So what do we do?
Well, I think we've got to do two things, really. Number one, we've got to regularize the flow of immigration, put it on legal status, increase the border security, make it work in tandem with the workings of the labor market.
Now, does that mean we figure out a way to let people come here and be cheap labor?
Well, I think it does. I think that we've got a demand for labor in America that's not being realized by native-born people. I mean, the fact is, 50 years ago, when we had very little immigration, you had 30 or 40% of American males did not graduate from high school. We had a plentiful supply of low-skilled labor. Today, only about 10 or 15% of American males don't graduate from high school. We're not producing as much low-skilled labor. The good news is we're producing higher-skilled labor than we did in the past, proportionately. And so there's a demand for low-skilled labor. In addition, we've also got large numbers of high-skill immigrants who have made substantial contributions to the to this economy. Silicon Valley without immigrants wouldn't be Silicon Valley.
We have a community here in the St. Louis area called Valley Park. It's a suburb, and they are the first in the area to get their own local illegal immigration law. The mayor and the city attorney drafted this thing, and it was passed unanimously by the town council. And I had the city attorney on here last week, and I asked him, is there a big illegal immigrant problem in Valley Park? And he said, no, not really. And they put the law into effect, and one of the parts of it was English only on all city documents. Is that a direction we should be heading?
Well, I think, we have done not as good a job of assimilation as we did 100 years ago, not as good a job of teaching immigrants to speak, read, and write the English language and teaching their children. We've had too much bilingual education, which too often is neither bilingual nor education. It's instruction in bad Spanish. As far as official documents are concerned, we have the Congress reiterating now that we're going to have bilingual ballots. I don't know why we should have bilingual ballots when we have when we have a requirement that you know English for citizenship, it simply makes no sense. That's a stop to political correctness, to the silly view that you have to tolerate all sorts of languages when, in fact, the language of public discourse and government in this country is English. I think there's a legitimate point in using foreign languages by government if there is a safety reason for doing so. For example, if you have a lot of Spanish language people legally in the country in your community, or you've got a lot of tourists, you may want to put up signs in foreign languages as well as English, stop signs in two languages. They do this in many countries. I don't think that's a threat to assimilation.
What's the problem with bilingual education?
Well, the problem is too long, often it's been neither bilingual nor education. If you're holding kids in Spanish language instruction, and it's often poor Spanish.
Are you talking about American English-speaking kids who learn Spanish?
No, I'm talking about schools where you have kids kept in Spanish for 3, 4, 5, 6 years in Spanish language instruction, and there's a bunch of wacky academics that have theories that somehow they're going to learn everything better.
So you're talking about Latino kids who don't speak English, and instead of putting them into an English as a second language program, they're being educated in an American school solely in Spanish?
That's right. And the education elites, the university elites like this idea. It's multicultural. We're showing tolerance. We're not doing these kids any favors. If they're going to succeed in American life, if they're going to climb the economic ladder, if they're going to contribute creatively to our economy and to our culture, they've got to know English. And the sooner they start learning it, the better. And in fact, there's pretty much proof that it works much better. The voters of California took this in hand in 1998 and passed Proposition 227, which limited English, Spanish language instruction, foreign language instruction, but it's mostly in Spanish, to 1 year. I interviewed Superintendent Roy Romer of the Los Angeles Unified School District last week, and he showed me how the test scores have risen in Los Angeles Unified District that's got 730,000 students, 80% of them Latino, after the passage of that proposition. He also noted that parents are entitled under this proposition to request that their kids get more than 1 year of Spanish language instruction. He said, very few parents make that request. It's the intellectual elites that want this Spanish language instruction and the Spanish Language Teachers Union, not the parents of these kids.
So the 1 year is to help these kids segue from a Spanish-only environment to some English, and then they are mainstreamed into the regular classrooms?
That's right. You want to get a view towards moving them into English as fast as possible. Some of these kids have never heard much English in the course of their life. But I'll tell you something that's interesting about how the kids vote with their clickers. And that's the complaint of the Spanish language television network, Univision. Their biggest problem, they say, is not among adults. They've got a good audience among Spanish language people, and they like to watch the Latin American telenovelas and so forth. But the kids don't want to watch it. The kids in those households want to watch English language television. They're voting with their clickers for assimilation. It's the intellectual elites which are working against it.
Although in Los Angeles, the top five radio stations out there include, I think, at least two Spanish language radio stations, and they're playing, popular Spanish language music, and that's mostly younger listeners.
Well, they're not as dominant in the audience as KMOX is in St. Louis.
Well, nobody is.
Nobody is. But the fact is, yeah, there's a market for that, and you know, I've driven through Texas and listened to stations that play L Top 10.
Uh-huh.
There's kind of mixture. The announcers segue from Spanish to English and back and forth in the same sentence. I don't think that's too dangerous, but I think I think the overwhelming majority of immigrants want to assimilate, want to have their kids assimilate into America. They're in favor of what President Theodore Roosevelt 100 years ago called Americanization. Yes, some immigrants intend to and do go back home, but that was true 100 years ago among the Italian immigrants who in many ways resemble the Latino immigrants of today. The majority want to stay here. The majority want their kids to move ahead in society. The majority understand that the English language is essential to do that.
Okay, so then does the government have to play a role in that? Does the federal government or the state government have to force these people to assimilate? Or does time and their own desire to assimilate take care of that without governmental help?
I think
that's the libertarian question coming out of me.
Yeah, well, a lot of the process will go on without government help. I've been particularly unhappy with the government hindrance of this, with the government, with things like bilingual education and bilingual ballots, which suggests that Spanish is the language of public discourse and government in our country, which it is not. And I think it set roadblocks in the way of kids assimilating and moving up in the world. 100 years ago, they had a better idea, and I sometimes say that if I had my way and could be a magician for a day, I would have our public schools run by the people who ran the public schools of New York City in 1906. They had the right idea. They caused these immigrant kids to assimilate and to excel. Our education elites are not doing as good a job today.
Now, you've referred to this a couple of times, particularly things a century ago, and you said a moment ago that the Latinos today are like the Italians of 100 years ago, and you write in the book that Asians today are like Jews 100 years ago. Explain that for people like me who are not alive 100 years ago and don't know the history.
Well, there's important resemblances. I sometimes hear people say, well, the immigrants of 100 years ago were white, so there was no problem assimilating. They weren't perceived as being white then. They were perceived as being of other races. That was the language that people used in those days about Irish, Italians, Poles, Jews, other races. And yet, nonetheless, we think today of their descendants not as being, quote, other races, but as being white Americans. What the heck?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, this feeling is today these immigrants can't be assimilated. Well, you know, the Latino immigrants today resemble Italian immigrants of 100 years ago. They both came from societies with dysfunctional institutions, and as a result, they didn't trust institutions aside from the family and hard work. Those are the two things that you basically trusted. I mean, I tell the story of Mario Puzo's mother, an Italian immigrant lady living out on Long Island. He called her up and said, Ma, I just got great news. I got a $600,000 advance on the paperback edition of The Godfather. And before he could finish talking, she said, don't tell nobody. the distrust of others outside the family was so deep. And this produces behavior that, you have very hard work ethics among Hispanics. Hispanic males have higher workforce participation than any other measured group. You have early school dropout, distrust of those of the schools. You actually have relatively, compared to American blacks, lower crime rates and welfare dependency rates. They tend to get jobs in the private sector rather than the public sector. They don't trust the government very much. And if you grew up with the Mexican government, you wouldn't trust government very much either.
Yeah, well, my grandparents were Eastern European Jews, so they certainly had a government they didn't trust. And when they came here, it was a matter of having to learn it all over again at the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, yeah, today's Asians, East Asians, South Asians, in many ways resemble the Jews of 100 years ago. They're people who have been persecuted minorities, the Jews in the Tsarist Empire, the the Koreans with the Korean War, the Vietnamese with the Vietnam War, Chinese refugees from communist China, etc. They've been persecuted peoples with high traditions of literacy and numeracy, great experience in commerce. You pass, many of the attitudes habits of mind are passed down through the family, and the habits of commerce, of literacy, are passed down through these families. And so what you see from the immigrant Asian kids of today, as you saw from the immigrant Jewish kids of 100 years ago, amazingly impressive academic performance, very good performance in college. Another similarity, they're discriminated against, not by evil backwoods racist religious right or something like that. They're discriminated against by the liberal elites that run the colleges and universities with racial quotas and preferences, which tend to work against them because they have high test scores. It's very similar to the quotas, the ceilings on the number of Jews in the Ivy League colleges that were imposed in the 1920s and maintained till the 1960s. Those college deans used to say, well, we can't have too many Jews here because we depend on alumni for contributions, and obviously these Jews are poor and will never earn any money.
Yeah.
To which I say, goyishikov.
Yeah. okay. And by the way, thank you to Mel Gibson for the donation. You're from Detroit, Michael. You were talking earlier about assimilation and how we need to look at that as one of the key factors in this country. But Detroit has a very large Muslim population in the city and in its suburbs that doesn't seem to want to assimilate. What can we do about that?
Well, it's got a large Arab population. Many are descended from Christian Arabs, as well as Muslim. I think that could be a problem. I mean, the fact is that you have among some Muslim immigrants a very oppositional attitude to the United States. Although I would also note that in Dearborn, the suburb with the largest Arab population or percentage of in the Detroit metro area, there was a victory parade when the United States troops steamed into Baghdad. People were celebrating in the streets the freedom of the Iraqi people. So let us not suppose that all these people are opposed to United States foreign policy or towards the liberation of Iraq.
No, but there, and I know in Northern Virginia and in other enclaves around this country where you do have fundamentalist Islamic communities of people who live together, work together, and send their kids to school together, you run into a lot of this extremist, fundamentalist, and particularly Wahhabist mentality being passed on from generation to generation right here inside the United States.
Well, I think a couple things that need to be done. We do not want to have this Wahhabi Islam that's the religion of Saudi Arabia taught widely and disseminated through public institutions. It turns out that in a number of states, Wahhabi clerics have been appointed as chaplains in prisons. That should stop. I think also we have a legitimate interest in keeping an eye on what's happening in a lot of these Wahhabi mosques that have been financed by the Saudis and which are preaching hatred around our country and, you know, out in Fairfax, Virginia, where one of the alumni of this became a terrorist as well. So, yes, I think we need to do more. We need to take security seriously. We actually have a rather small immigrant population from Muslim countries nationally. Much smaller than they have in several of the European countries.
But it only takes a few to build a cell.
Well, and we might want to consider restricting immigration from those countries. That is a possibility. Certainly, we've been too liberal in giving out visas. The State Department used to have a program in Saudi Arabia called Visa Express.
Yeah.
The applicants didn't have to come in for the job. They did for an interview. We were proud that we got the visas over to them in record time and took directly to their travel agents and so forth. That was exposed by Reuters' Joel Mowbray, I think, on National Review Online. The State Department dug in its heels and tried to resist getting rid of Visa Express, but fortunately they were finally overridden.
It sickens me that we suck up to Saudi Arabia. It's all because of the black goo they have under their sand, but when they call themselves our partner in peace, the hair on the back of my neck goes up.
Yeah, I think that's a real problem, and the fact is the Saudi government has been somewhat more cooperative with us, not nearly as much as they need to be in the fight against terrorism, and by propagating this hate-filled Wahhabi Islam in the United States and around the world, they're contributing negatively.
Yep. Let's get back to immigration for just a second here. People were upset back at the beginning of May when there were all those pro-immigration rallies when they saw people waving the Mexican flag. You write in the book that that's not really as much of a problem as some people made it out to be.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, if you confine your inquiry to professors of Chicano studies at third-line universities in California, you'll find that they think the Southwest United States could become part of Mexico again, or a separate republic of Aztlan, or something like that. And you did see kids released from school in Los Angeles, and they went out on a lark on these big demonstrations. A lot of fun waving the Mexican flag. I don't take it too seriously because I've interviewed Mexican immigrants. I've asked them whether or not they want to have the system of government and law of Mexico here in the United States. And you know what their response is? They laugh and laugh and laugh. It's one of the funniest things they've ever heard.
It's no different than going to the Hill, the Italian section of St. Louis here, where all the Italian restaurants are, and you see the tricolor Italian flag hanging from people's houses. Doesn't mean that they hate America.
Doesn't mean they hate America. Doesn't mean they want the regime that governed Italy from 1922 to 43, the Mussolini regime here. That's right. You know, they don't want the system of government and law that obtains in southern Italy or used to,
right,
to obtain in the United States. So I think, you know, the most Latino immigrants are not interested in planning a Latin system of law and government here. They're interested in working and making money and raising their families so that they can do better. That's what the immigrants here did 100 years ago, and they're doing the same thing today.
And would President Bush's guest worker idea help that make that happen?
Well, I think we have to regularize our immigration flow so they work in tandem with the labor market. Trying to stop people from coming across the border for whom there is a demand in the labor market and who are willingly supplying it is a very, very difficult thing to do when you're working against basic economic forces. We don't produce as many low-skill workers in the United States as we did 50 years ago when immigration was minimal. We have a demand for that kind of work. I think we need to regularize it. Some people say that current illegals should be required to leave the country and then apply again from their country of origin. Other people say they should be allowed to apply to regularize their status here, pay fines, pay their back taxes, although the Senate bill has them paying only part of their back taxes, which strikes me as kind of silly. They should pay them all. You know, I look with favor on the proposal of Congressman Mike Pence and Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, who are both conservative Republicans, for a free market guest worker system. Would require application in the country of origin, would use private sector firms like the temporary worker firms that have been so successful in matching people to jobs here in the United States, to match people with jobs and to have a limited guest worker permit. There's a lot of room to argue about the details of this, exactly how it should be conducted. There's important policy issues to decide. I'm not here to tell you that I can set myself up as a chairman of the House-Senate Conference Committee to give you the exact solution, but I think we should be thinking in those terms. We want to stop illegal crossings. We need to strengthen the border. We also need to regularize the flow of immigration that is going to occur in tandem with market forces. We want to know who's in our country, and this may require something in the nature of immigrant or even national identity cards. The government of Mexico has a voter identification card that has proved largely tamper-proof in Mexico. And in fact, I think Mexican elections probably have less vote fraud, fewer people illegally voting than you have, say, in St. Louis City. So this is not impossible for us to do, and it's an interesting case of one way we can learn from the experience of Mexico and improve our own performance.
Yeah, I disagree with you on the national ID card. I do think we should have a national driver's license in this country, so when you move from one place to another, you don't have to go through that whole process again. But that's another story for another day.
Well, the identity card sticks in my craw, too, but I think it may be something that we may have to go to.
Michael, thanks for your time. I appreciate it very much. Michael Barone's book is called The New Americans, How the Melting Pot Can Work Again. He's also a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Michael Barone here on The Paul Harris Show. This is News Talk 1120 KMOX.